This time, a new weekly constitutional. Should physician-assisted suicide be a constitutional right?
All of those concerns about the competence and free will of patients making those decisions already exist in the context of the rejection of life-sustaining medical treatment.
That was Norman Cantor, but we'll also hear from Samantha Crane.
It's not simply a matter of autonomy versus no autonomy. This is about making sure that the lives of people with illnesses and disabilities are treated on the same par as the lives of people without disabilities.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about physician-assisted suicide.
Don't change that station. It's time for your weekly constitutional, a weekly discussion of interesting constitutional issues from gay rights to gun rights. YWC is produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier and is hosted by Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law in Knoxville, Tennessee.
Without ever coming right out and saying it, the United States Supreme Court has essentially held that you and I and any other competent adult has the right to refuse medical care, even if that care is necessary to save our lives. But the court's never gone the next step. It's never declared that we have a constitutional right to physician-assisted suicide, something that most states still prohibit, in fact, even criminalize. Today, we're going to revisit this debate. We're going to be talking with two experts. A little later on, we'll hear from a woman named Samantha Crane, who works with a disability advocacy group called Not Dead Yet. This group is very much opposed to physician-assisted suicide. But first, we'll hear from Norman Cantor. He's a law professor. He's been involved with medical care decisions and right-to-die decisions ever since the Karen N. Quinlan case of the 1970s.
My name is Norman Cantor. I'm an emeritus professor of law. I taught at Rutgers Law School in New Jersey between 1970 and 2005, when I retired from teaching. And I've taught a variety of subjects, but one of them is the legal aspects of death and dying. And that's where I've done most of my research and writing, issues relating to death and dying.
Well, I share your fascination with that topic, but we have to admit it's a little bit, well, it's quite literally morbid. How come death and dying? Why did that attract your attention?
I started teaching in 1970, and I come from a neighborhood health center, which involved the interaction of law and medicine. So I had that focus coming into my teaching career. By happenstance, very early on when I was teaching at Rutgers in about 1972, the New Jersey Supreme Court ruled that the state could give a blood transfusion despite the fact that the patient was a Jehovah's Witness and did not want that kind of treatment. I thought that was such a wrong decision that prompted me to write a case note of condemning that case. And within a couple more years, the case of Quinlan arose in New York, Karen Ann Quinlan.
Yes.
Probably the most famous case in medico-legal jurisprudence. And I became involved because I had just written this case note on a right to refuse treatment. And the attorney who was handling Quinlan came to my office, and back in 1975, we shaped together the strategy for litigating Quinlan. And it was those experiences with cases of the New Jersey Supreme Court that prompted my fascination with the topic of death and dying, and that became the focus of my career.
That was an extremely important case, and it established the extremely important precedent that people do in fact have a right, competent adults anyway, to refuse life-saving medical treatment or any medical treatment if they choose. Some people might not be as familiar with the facts of that case. So just briefly, what was Karen Ann Quinlan's situation?
Karen Ann Quinlan was a 20-year-old daughter of parents who filed a petition after Karen became immersed in a permanent coma and wanted to detach her from the respirator, feeling that that's what she would want if she was going to be permanently unconscious. And the New Jersey prosecutors and even her physicians were reluctant to detach her from the respirator, feeling that that was a form of killing, and they weren't clear that that was permissible. So Joseph Quinlan, her father, petitioned the courts to be appointed a formal guardian and allowed to detach her respirator. And that's the famous case that made it to the New Jersey Supreme Court. And in 1976, the New Jersey Supreme Court ruled that her father could be appointed guardian, that she would have a right, if she were able, to reject the respirator, the life-preserving respirator. Even though she was incompetent, her father was an appropriate agent to exercise that right on her behalf.
Very important, and as I always tell my students, it boils down to typically, you know, in that circumstance where a person's been struck down, what would that person's intent be? It's so important to have a living will or a power of attorney or something of that sort, a healthcare power of attorney, to avoid that sort of litigation in the future. But wow, that's just remarkable that you were involved in that case. And then this segued into a related issue, and that's physician-assisted suicide.
Over the years, the ways for fatally stricken patients to cope with their affliction has plagued both doctors and patients and the courts. Even though Quinlan talked about a right to detach life-preserving medical treatment, subsequently people have felt that even before they become attached to machinery, even though they're not machinery dependent, if they're dying patients, fatally stricken, they may be suffering and they may want to hasten their deaths and turning to physician assistants to get a poison is the principal channel that people have chosen to pursue.
And that is something that's been litigated. It's been litigated all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, hasn't it?
That's correct. The claim that the dying patients have been making is that they should be entitled to control not just the medical intervention in terms of machinery, but that they ought to have access to a poison. And they're claiming that that's a part of their liberty interest, their self-determination interest that ought to be recognized. Not just resistance to medical treatment, but access to a substance that will hasten their death.
And of course, doctors in jurisdictions where there's no established right to this are understandably reluctant, even if they're sympathetic, because, of course, probably they'd be guilty of murder under most existing laws in most states if they actually, and they'd lose their licenses, of course, if they did this sort of thing.
That's right. In the vast majority of the United States, assistance to suicide, such as the provision of a fatal means, and like a poison, is some form of homicide, or aiding and abetting suicide is some form of criminal act in the vast majority of states. Only in 5 states has the legislation been altered to permit assisted suicide.
And that was in the wake of one of those cases you mentioned, the Washington versus Glucksberg case. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, the state of Oregon was the first state to authorize physician assistance to suicide. The state of Washington was the second, and that followed the Supreme Court's rejection of a constitutional claim in Washington v. Glucksberg, and subsequently 3 other states, I think now Vermont, Colorado, and California, have authorized assistance to suicide. But were you asking me to talk about Washington v. Glucksberg, the constitutional challenge?
Yes, please. And the companion case, or I think it was a companion case, the VACO case.
Okay, sure. Washington v. Glucksberg, which made it to the Supreme Court in 1997, was a claim by dying patients, terminally ill patients, and physicians serving terminally ill patients, that as a matter of liberty under the 14th Amendment, the dying patients ought to be able to obtain physician assistance in ending their unavoidably terminal condition. And they were successful in the Ninth Circuit, and they got a ruling that the Washington prohibition on physician assistance to suicide violated the Liberty Clause of the Federal Constitution. That went up to the United States Supreme Court. And in 1997, then Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote an opinion rejecting that constitutional claim, saying that it was wrong to call assistance to suicide a fundamental aspect of liberty, or to call suicide a fundamental aspect of liberty, that the traditions and collective conscience of the people did not show any kind of veneration of suicide, and therefore all that government needed, such as the state of Washington, was some rational basis to outlaw assistance to suicide. And he found that rational basis in the interest in protecting people against undue influence in ending their lives.
And there are arguments on that side. I mean, there are policy arguments that if you legalize physician-assisted suicide, that the daughters and sons may pressure parents who are elderly and ill to kill themselves so that they can inherit their wealth or avoid its depletion through medical care. There are concerns that people might collude and actually kill somebody and pretend that it was a suicide. There are concerns that people make mistakes, that there might not be a terminal illness involved and that someone might recover. There are more philosophical concerns that every human life is valuable right up to the last breath that's naturally taken. So there are arguments that people have made on this basis, and Justice Rehnquist basically said that it was perfectly okay for a state to accept those arguments and to outlaw physician-assisted suicide.
Yes, but all of those concerns about the competence and free will of the patients making those decisions already exist in the context of the rejection of life-sustaining medical treatment. And we've been operating with that as a fundamental liberty right for many decades now, both because of the involvement of physicians and medical staff as sort of guardians of the patient and observers of the process. None of the parade of terribles has materialized in that context of managing medical intervention. And I frankly don't see any reason to think that the hazards or the concerns are any sharper in the context of a physician prescribing a poison than in pulling the plug on the respirator or other medical machinery or ending dialysis or any of the multitude of steps that physicians currently take.
In other words, there's no rational distinction that a legislature might make between those two things. We've already got one, so it might be irrational not to allow the other. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Today, our subject is physician-assisted suicide. We've been speaking thus far with Norman Cantor. He's an emeritus professor of law at Rutgers University, and he's been involved in these cases and these situations for many decades. A little later on, we'll hear from Samantha Crane from a group called Not Dead Yet. Stick around. You're listening to your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been speaking thus far with Norman Cantor. He's an emeritus professor of law from Rutgers, and he's been telling me why he thinks that physician-assisted suicide should be a constitutional right. Before we leave Washington versus Glucksberg, though, let's acknowledge then that the court said, on the one hand, it's permissible constitutionally for a state to outlaw physician-assisted suicide, but it also acknowledged that it was permissible for the state to do the opposite. In fact, there was almost an invitation toward the end of Chief Justice Rehnquist's opinion, where he said the debate is ongoing and it can continue and states can make up their minds. And that's what happened. I mean, in the aftermath of this opinion, Washington and the several other states you've mentioned have decided to allow various forms of physician-assisted suicide. And what has been their experience, broadly speaking?
Oregon and Washington have now operated under that system for quite a while. Vermont, Colorado, and California are just initiating the systems. And as you point out, the courts endorse any legislative decisions to permit assistance to suicide. The problem is that it's taken a glacial pace for the legislatures to respond. We're now 40 years after Quinlan talked about the right of a terminally ill patient to hasten their death. And in only five of the United States have the legislatures taken up that challenge and permitted it, as Rehnquist suggested. And in terms of what the results have been, I think the experience is that the feared abuses have not materialized. The hazards of administering poisons to incompetent people or overcoming their will or not allowing them full information about their conditions, that none of those feared abuses have materialized, which just reinforces the constitutional claim that there ought to be a right to manage the dying process for people who are unavoidably dying.
One other argument that was raised, I believe, in those states that have legalized physician-assisted suicide is that they realized that they would be pioneers in this regard, and they were concerned about so-called suicide tourism. If I'm in Washington state and I legalize this, does that mean people from across the United States are going to drag themselves over here in their dying days and commit suicide here? Is this going to be some sort of a public relations black eye for us? Has there been any evidence of that happening?
No, I don't think there's very much of that. States can establish as part of their legislative package a requirement that only residents, genuine state domiciliaries, are entitled to use the process that's been endorsed. And they can use residency requirements, and I'm not aware of any significant tourist issue. Switzerland, by contrast, has allowed people to come and quickly establish medical contact and to obtain assistance in suicide just by appearing in the jurisdiction, and they do have what you might call an issue of suicide tourism.
Well, I don't mean to make light of this, but if I were in that situation, I think being able to spend my final minutes looking at the Alps would not be a bad way to go. So I think they've got a special circumstance there. More generally, have people taken advantage of this? Has there been a wave of physician-assisted suicides in Washington or Oregon?
I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, but the processes are being utilized. Not all physicians participate and are willing to cooperate in providing a fatal prescription, but it's happening, and it's mostly, I think, cancer patients and ALS patients and Parkinson's patients who've decided to take that route. The processes are working without significant abuse or mishap, to the best of my knowledge.
All right. Well, that brings us to the case that brought you to my attention, and that's the Myers case, recently decided in the state of New York. Could you tell me about that, please?
Yeah, well, Myers was a similar challenge to what I described in Washington and Glucksberg, that is, terminally ill, competent patients and cooperating physicians petitioned the New York courts asking for a declaration that the prohibition on physician assistance to suicide violated their state constitutional rights.
That was an equal protection argument, wasn't it?
Yeah. The thrust of their argument was equal protection, and I think that is the strongest argument. And what they're contending is that given the current circumstances of death and dying, in which law has permitted several different forms of hastening one's death, it's arbitrary, capricious, irrational to exclude the provision of a poison from the variety of means that are available to hasten one's death lawfully. And that was the claim that the New York Court of Appeals was considering. And they pretty summarily rejected the equal protection claim, adopting what I think is the rather superficial approach of Chief Justice Rehnquist in Vacco v. Quill, in which he said, well, there's really no discrimination, there are no classifications here. Nobody is entitled to get assistance in suicide, and everyone is entitled to reject medical intervention. So there's really no classification here. And I contend that that's a superficial, inaccurate way to portray the issues. The equal protection challenge really involves medical management of the dying process for any competent, fatally stricken individual. And we know that there are some lawful ways in which a fatally stricken individual can hasten their death. One of them is if they happen to be connected to medical machinery, such as a respirator, or dependent on a machine such as dialysis, they're entitled to reject those medical interventions. Incidentally, it can be even a more simplistic medical intervention like artificial nutrition and hydration in the face of a eating disorder. In any event, they're absolutely entitled to reject that kind of medical intervention, even though it's going to hasten their death. Another way in which fatally stricken patients can hasten their death is by stopping eating and drinking, precipitating their own deaths by dehydration over a course of about 10 to 14 days. And that's considered a lawful entitlement of a fatally stricken patient, even though they're precipitating their own death, even though it has overtones of suicide. And physicians are entitled to provide medical backup and care to the patient who is rejecting, who has stopped eating and drinking and is rejecting artificial nutrition and hydration. So that's another legal form. And so the argument is, given these perfectly legal forms of self-deliverance, of hastening one's own death, it doesn't make a lot of sense to exclude the more humane provision of a poison when you can die in a matter of minutes as opposed to 10 to 14 days of deterioration and semi-conscious lingering.
one of them that you pointed out that's even closer is that the physicians are allowed to give pain medication to the point of inducing unconsciousness, which might persist until that patient dies of dehydration or for whatever underlying cause. But they have to be very careful not to give too much that might kill them immediately.
Yeah, I don't use the terminal sedation contrast so much because, as I understand it, the legality of terminal sedation is confined to people who are really on the throes of death, on the verge mm-hmm. of death. And the people that are interested in the assistance to suicide are terminally ill patients who may be significantly removed from the verge of death, but are nonetheless unhappy and suffering and wish to have a form of self-deliverance. So it's true that terminal sedation is another legal option, but that's pretty much confined to a narrow class of patients.
And your criticism then of the Myers decision, if I may characterize it, is simply that by distinguishing between these various legal and illegal methods, the court is allowing the state to be irrational. And that, of course, is not allowed under equal protection analysis. You cannot act arbitrarily and be irrational when you distinguish between people.
Quite right, and that's particularly so if, in contrast to Chief Justice Rehnquist, we say that the liberty interest that's involved, how to respond to a fatal affliction, is not just plain liberty, but a fundamental aspect of liberty. And I think some judges would take that position, even though it hasn't yet prevailed. In other words, if that's the case, even a rational basis wouldn't be enough to sustain the legislation.
Okay, one or two more questions. First of all, on a philosophical basis, could one make the argument that a competent adult should be able to get physician-assisted suicide even if that person is not terminally ill? I seem to recall that the Canadian Supreme Court recently found a right to physician-assisted suicide, and it didn't specifically mention terminal illness, but simply intolerable suffering.
That's right. The European model, the Dutch and the Swiss, is similar. They offer the option of assistance to suicide, even though the patient doesn't meet the definition of unavoidably dying within a short period. They respond, they being Switzerland and Holland, and some advocates in the United States, and Canada as well, they want just irredeemable suffering to be the criterion for qualifying for assistance to suicide, not suffering in the course of a terminal illness.
That makes the argument a little bit more difficult. As a matter of policy, is that something that you think would be a good idea?
As a matter of policy, I think it's a poor strategy if one wants to make the constitutional claim and have it seriously accepted. You have to confine the class of people that you're trying to benefit in some fashion, and just you don't want to say it's a fundamental aspect of liberty for every unhappy person to have access to suicide.
One last question that I will let you go. I happen to have run into Dr. Jack Kevorkian about 10 years ago. Shortly before he passed away, my sister happened to live in Royal Oak, Michigan, where he was from, and I literally saw him on the street riding his adult tricycle off to a political rally, and recognized him and spoke to him briefly. Did you ever meet Dr. Kevorkian? Did you ever have any opinion of his activities all those years ago in Michigan?
I certainly never met him, but I was well aware of all his efforts for the sake of self-deliverance, but he was much too aggressive for my taste. He was not careful in accepting people who were genuinely terminally ill, and he was not careful in making sure that they understood their options. He was just irresponsibly rash in administering to people that he saw as suffering. And I don't think he did the cause of a constitutional claim to assistance in dying any good at all. I think he undermined that claim.
Yeah, he certainly did take a very aggressive stance, and he had some very strange quirks in his personality, though I must say that when I met him, he was a very pleasant fellow to speak to on the street for a few minutes. But I think you might be right. I think perhaps he set the cause back a few years. At any rate, Professor, we very much appreciate your taking some time to speak with us today. This is a fascinating issue, a very important issue, and thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and our subject this time is rather disturbing, the subject of physician assistant suicide. Should it be a constitutional right? Should it not? Recently, New York State decided no. We've been speaking with Norman Cantor, who thinks they made the wrong decision. After the break, we will speak with someone else on the other side of the debate. Her name is Samantha Crane, and she's from a group called Not Dead Yet. Stick around. And now it's time to continue our discussion of physician-assisted suicide. Now we'll hear from a person and a group that is against it.
I'm Sam Crane. I'm the Director of Public Policy at the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. We're the nation's leading 501c3, both by and for autistic people ourselves. I also am the chairwoman of the board at Not Dead Yet, which is a disability rights-focused organization that opposes assisted suicide and euthanasia.
That is a remarkably catchy name for a group. I remember the first time I saw it, and I thought to myself, that really gets one's attention, and it also, I think, sort of explains your position very pithily.
Yes, definitely.
Could you tell us more?
I think it's a Monty Python reference, actually.
Well, I wasn't going to make light of it by making that reference, but that did occur to me as well. You know, bring out your dead. I'm not dead yet. I'm feeling much better now.
There's a lot of humor in the disability rights community, so.
Oh, is there? Okay. Well, tell me about this group.
Well, Not Dead Yet has existed for decades at this point, and it's part of a broader disability rights movement that has been getting a lot more recognition recently. So I don't know if, you know, this last summer you paid attention to the news coverage around ADAPT, which is a disability rights organization that was protesting the Medicaid repeal bills, but ADAPT and Not Dead Yet are very closely linked. Not Dead Yet is sort of an organization that formed out of that original movement that ADAPT started in the 1970s.
When you say the Medicaid repeal bills, are you referring to the attempts by the Congress to repeal the so-called Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and the Medicaid expansion?
Yes.
Okay.
We really focused on the Medicaid expansion aspect.
I actually do recall those protests, and they were, again, very effective. I mean, there were a number of people with disabilities, and many of them in wheelchairs, that were essentially right outside the offices of many members of Congress. That was quite a visual appeal.
Yeah, ADAPT really, you know, started with protests around inaccessibility of public buildings and inaccessibility of public transit, and putting yourself in the way of a bad policy in a very physical way is kind of how ADAPT started, and that's still their strategy.
I'm sure you're familiar with the seminal case of Tennessee versus Lane, which of course involved the Americans with Disabilities Act and its applicability to state governments. We actually had the attorney who litigated that case all the way to the Supreme Court, and one of the things that really stuck with me was that the plaintiff in that case actually was a criminal defendant who couldn't get to court, literally was crawling up the steps to the courthouse.
And we had adept protesters, have done exactly that. They've crawled up the steps of Congress, of the Supreme Court, in order to illustrate the inaccessibility of our public spaces.
Pretty effective. Okay, so you've got this group with a very effective strategy, a very effective name. And I think, generally speaking, most people listening are probably supportive, at least in theory, of helping people with disabilities and making sure that they can get around and lead their lives. But specifically, physician-assisted suicide, why is that such a big issue for your group?
I think it's important to really get at the experience of a lot of people with disabilities, especially if people have acquired a disability. Many of the leaders of ADAPT, for example, were polio survivors, people who had acquired a physical disability or had a progressive physical disability, some of whom had a physical disability from birth as well. And many have the experience of doctors sort of saying to their parents at the time they're diagnosed, you know, this person is not going to have a rewarding life. Some people with polio had overheard their parents be told, you know, you better hope he dies of polio because he's going to be a vegetable for the rest of his life. Mm. And so we all have a very visceral sense that our lives are not respected, our lives are not valued as much, especially by the medical establishment, as lives of people without disabilities.
And so the concern is then that given that lack of respect, that mm-hmm. those physicians, that very same community, might wish to engage, if allowed to legally, in some form mm-hmm. of some form of euthanasia, that we might actually have guardians or parents of children with disabilities or relatives of adults with disabilities taking advantage of the decriminalization of physician-assisted suicide to make those decisions or to pressure disabled people into euthanasia.
Yeah, and we've even seen it happen. There was a very high-profile case, the Latimer case in Canada, in which a father killed his disabled daughter, who was a child at the time, and he claimed afterwards that he had engaged in mercy killing and he shouldn't be prosecuted for murder. He went to jail for murder, fortunately, but eventually was released at the end of his sentence, and he has continued to advocate for euthanasia of children with disabilities. So it's really not a hypothetical situation that mm-hmm. we're worried about. It's a very real concern.
I've actually heard it said that euthanasia is far more common than people would think, and that physicians, perhaps with the best of motives, are engaging in it on a daily basis. They're simply doing it very quietly. Is that your sense that sort of thing is happening?
That's definitely consistent with some of the stories that we've heard. It's also extremely concerning. You know, I have a friend who is frequently in hospitals. She has had nurses approach her and tell her, you know, we could just give you some extra morphine. You would go painlessly. Just let us know. And who really felt very pressured by that. And, you know, part of the concern is that because people are doing this kind of outside of supervision, you know, a lot of people are worried that someone might do that to them.
So there's already a problem even with the current regime, which by and large does not allow physician-assisted suicide. And
Right. Your
concern is that it would become more widespread if physicians or nurses and others had the cover of legalized physician-assisted suicide. Mm-hmm. Going a little bit more deeply, I'm just curious, do your friends and colleagues who have experienced this sort of pressure to be euthanized, do they sense that the intention of the people suggesting this is good or bad? I mean, is this, misguided as they may be, is the nurse who comes and makes such an offer guided by some sense of mercy?
Clearly, if the nurse thought of themselves as a murderer, they wouldn't have come out and said it that
unless,
way.
Unless they really were murderers.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, nurses are people too, and directors are people too, and they can have good motives or bad. I'm just kind of trying to see it from their perspective. I mean, do they see themselves as angels of mercy, or are they demons?
Well, this is something that's very common among people without disabilities. is people without disabilities genuinely think, if I were disabled, I wouldn't want to live anymore. Mm-hmm. We have people with disabilities who are out in public, you know, going grocery shopping. Random strangers will come up to them and say, you're so strong. If I were in a wheelchair, I would kill myself. And that's certainly not a really great thing that you want to hear from a stranger when you're going grocery shopping, but it illustrates a real genuine belief, I think, among a lot of people without disabilities, that death is preferable to disability.
You know, I've actually heard that. I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't know already, but I will hear from people used to be sitting watching television or something, and they say, "Man, if that ever happens to me, just pull the plug."
Right.
And what I'm hearing from you is that that's not the case, and that disabled lives are lives worth living.
Yeah, and another thing that I think is important to raise in this context is a lot of people who are just first diagnosed with a disability or they've just acquired a disability, because of that pervasive attitude in society, they do feel suicidal. I have friends who, you know, were injured in a car accident, developed a significant physical disability as a result. And in those few weeks or months after their injury, they certainly did feel suicidal, and they are very open about that. As people adapt and are offered supports, are offered technology and accommodations, people typically feel a lot better. And also, they need to be given competent grief counseling and mental health services to help them with depression, which is very common in the aftermath of a diagnosis or an injury.
Okay, I think I understand your concerns now. So let me play devil's advocate. The devil's advocate would say, sorry, as he or she is, that there are people with disabilities who suffer these disabilities, that most people don't have them. And if I'm a competent adult and I'm don't have a disability, but perhaps I do have a terminal illness, or I do have some sort of condition that is causing me a horrible suffering, that I, as a competent adult, should have that right, whether I'm disabled or not, I should have that right under the Constitution, under perhaps some sort of fundamental right under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment or somewhere else in the Constitution. I should be allowed, just as I'm allowed to deny myself medical care, even life-saving medical care, I should have that right. How do you respond to that, to people who say, you know, I'm concerned about disabled people, but I've got my rights too?
Well, there are a few different points that I want to raise in response to that. First, when you look at the records that we have from states like Oregon, in which assisted suicide is already legal, disability, loss of autonomy, inability to do the things that you used to do, is a leading reason for choosing assisted suicide. This is based on the reports that doctors are required to file when they prescribe a lethal medication. So actually, pain and suffering is one of the least frequently cited concerns. Most people with terminal illness do experience disability as part of the progression of that illness. Mm-hmm. And that's commonly what people will end up saying is the reason why they're choosing to end their lives.
So you're saying that the records we have from the states that do allow physician-assisted suicide indicate that people are specifically saying, I wish to end my life because I am disabled.
They're saying that they wish to end their life because they feel like a burden on their family, because they've lost their autonomy, because they can't do things that they used to be able to do. Those are all signs that they're really thinking about disability.
Okay, now I understand your perspective on this, and I understand, I believe I do, but I come back to it. If I am an adult and I'm competent and I suffer some terrible disability, and I simply make a decision that that's too much for me. It might not be too much for the next guy or the next woman, but it's too much for me, and I don't want to live my life anymore. Shouldn't I be able to make that decision as a competent adult?
This is a point that we made in our amicus brief in Myers. What if I don't have any illness or disability? I simply don't want to live anymore. Maybe I lost a lot of money in the stock market. Maybe I believe I have a sincere belief that humanity is bad for the planet. There certainly are people with this belief. Why are we offering physician-assisted suicide to people who have an illness, but not necessarily to other competent adults? I think the clear message is that disability or illness is a good, rational reason to use physician-assisted suicide, whereas other reasons are not. And that's something that we would really worry is sending a message about people with disabilities that disabled lives are inherently worth less, that they're less worth living.
That's a very interesting point you make, because I've raised that question before. I mean, if we're going to allow physician-assisted suicide for terminally ill patients or for patients who are in very bad pain, and we're doing it on the basis that they are consenting adults, why not allow the same thing for anybody who decides for any reason that he or she does no longer wish to live? And I had been thinking of it from that perspective, from a rights perspective, but you pointed out that by doing the opposite, by only allowing it in the circumstances, for example, that Oregon or Washington State might do, that we're actually stigmatizing disability.
Mm-hmm. And we've also seen expansion, especially in places where physician-assisted suicide was recognized as a right. We've seen progressive litigation attempting to expand it. In Canada, physician-assisted suicide has been legalized for people who have mental capacity to make the decision, and only for people who have a six-month terminal prognosis. There's already litigation to say, you know, that it's unfair to limit this to only people who have a six-month terminal prognosis, or that it's unfair to limit this to people who have mental capacity, because, you know, certainly someone who has lost some cognitive abilities is equally capable of suffering as a person who has full cognitive abilities. Can't we have a guardian make this decision on their behalf? Mm-hmm. And those are really troubling developments. I certainly don't want anyone to make the decision that my life is no longer worth living without my participation in that decision.
Yeah, I think I'd like to have a say as well. But what about this, though? What about the fact that right now, effectively, you have a right to refuse medical treatment, even life-saving medical treatment? You know, if you don't get this treatment, you're going to die. You can say no. You're a competent adult. You can even refuse, hydration tubes. You can essentially starve yourself or make yourself die of thirst. Given that we can do that, and that the court seems to acknowledge, if not specifically state, that we have a constitutional right to do that, is there really any difference between withholding food and water or withholding life-saving medical treatment on the one hand versus the physician coming over and simply giving an extra vial or two of morphine on the other?
I think that is a complicated question, and I think it's a matter of we certainly have to draw the line somewhere, right? We have to respect people's bodily autonomy. I think we probably should have laws in which people can refuse treatment because certainly people with disabilities have experienced forced treatment for a variety of things. It's generally traumatic, demoralizing, and I believe that people absolutely should be able to make their own decisions about what medications they receive. On the other hand, there is a difference between allowing a person to refuse a particular medication or a particular treatment and actively acting to end that person's life.
Well, I do see that there is, in some sense, a difference. I just don't know if ultimately it makes a difference because, and again, I'm just playing devil's advocate here. On the one hand, and I understand your position here as well, you want maximum autonomy for disabled people to refuse medical treatments or to direct the medical treatments that go into their bodies. That's completely understandable. But on the other hand, you would deny those same people the right to take that step of having the physician give them the extra morphine. Do you see any inconsistency there?
Let me ask you.
Sure, please.
If these are the same thing, why do we have a push for physician-assisted suicide?
Well, I think there are some people who are very concerned about dying in pain, great, terrible pain.
Absolutely. The concern about pain is a real concern. And I think you'll find that people who oppose physician-assisted suicide are also fighting very hard for better pain management at the end of life, up to and including things like terminal sedation, in which a person is entirely unconscious. They have been sedated. They are not feeling pain anymore. So I think that is because it's not an active attempt to end a person's life. It is an attempt to make a person comfortable and pain-free. That's the type of thing that people, disability rights advocates, tend to advocate for.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you say, these are very complicated, very difficult questions, which brings us to the most recent case. You referenced it just a moment ago, the Myers case in New York. Could you tell us your reaction to that? Or basically, tell us what it was about and then your reaction to it, please.
Myers was one of many cases filed in order to assert a constitutional right to physician-assisted suicide in New York. The case argued, or the plaintiffs argued, that you know, this was a matter of fundamental liberty and a matter of bodily autonomy. And what the disability rights groups, of which we were one of them, we filed an amicus brief explaining that there is a rational basis for the state to impose limits on physician-assisted suicide. We focused on the fact that, for example, suicide prevention is a legitimate goal of a government to make sure that people, you know, live long lives, and that a holding that would say that only people with disabilities have access to physician-assisted suicide, people with disabilities and people with illnesses, would be a difficult holding to keep limited in that way. So as I was explaining just earlier, you know, how would we limit that to only people with illnesses or disabilities if it's based on fundamental principles of autonomy? How can we make it limited to people with disabilities and people with illnesses without implying that illness or disability is somehow makes your life less worth living than other people's lives? How can we make sure that people with illnesses and disabilities have the same access to suicide prevention resources as other groups?
Well, you won. In fact, it was a pretty overwhelming vote, wasn't it?
Yeah, we were very pleased with that.
Well, congratulations to you. Did you participate in writing that amicus brief?
I reviewed it. I fortunately wasn't required to write it.
Uh-huh. Well?
We had a firm that was helping us write that brief.
Anything else you'd care to add about this issue before we finish off? We're running out of time here.
So one of the things that we really want to make clear is that it's not simply a matter of autonomy versus no autonomy. This is about making sure that the lives of people with illnesses and disabilities are treated on the same par as the lives of people without disabilities. We believe it would be inconsistent to have a law that says that some people get access to suicide prevention and some people get access to physician-assisted suicide. We want to make sure that people with disabilities and people with illnesses' lives are valued on the same level as the lives of others.
Well, Samantha Crane of Not Dead Yet, thank you very much for sharing your perspective with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And that's our show. Thanks very much to both of our guests, Sam Crane and Norman Cantor. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our scheduling is by Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.